Epilogue, 6 years later. Mitchell Thornberry looked downright wistful as they watched the starship lift off. There was no bellowing of rocket engines to disturb the scrubby desert landscape, no thunder of raw power. The lenticular-shaped craft, gleaming silver in the desert morning, rose slowly, almost silently, propelled by the same technology from New Earth that produced the almost ubiquitous energy shields. The tremendous crowd that arced across the desert for miles around fell silent, awed at the majesty of the takeoff of this first mission to rescue an alien civilization from the death wave.
"Ah, if I were a younger man," Thornberry muttered, his eyes following the spacecraft's majestically slow trajectory into the sky.
He was standing high above the desert floor, on the VIP visitor's deck of the White Sands spaceport, beside Jordan Aditi, the governor of New Mexico, and a small crowd of industrial magnates and politicians. Anita Halleck was conspicuously absent. Down below them, someone in the teeming crowd yelled, "Go!" More voices cheered the rising starship until the air rang with the chant, "Go! Go! Go!" As if in answer to their plea, the starship arced across the clear morning sky, accelerating now, faster and faster until it was a barely discernible streak of coruscating color against the cloudless blue.
"Go!" Thornberry joined the chorus. "Go!"
"You want to go star roving?" Jordan asked him, his expression cheerless.
"So do I," Thornberry replied. "Aye, I do, and that's the truth of it," with a shake of his head. "But I can't. Too many responsibilities. I'm pinned to Earth."
"I am too," said Jordan. Glancing at the VIPs standing all around them, he added in a lower voice, "I hate to think what Halleck would do if I went traipsing off to one of the threatened worlds."
"Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty," Thornberry quoted sadly.
"At least Paul's on his way," said Aditi.
"Yes," Jordan replied wanly.
"On his way to the stars."
Paul Longyear had leaped at the opportunity to be named chief biologist on the first rescue mission. Jordan had never seen the Native American smile so brightly as earlier that morning, when he boarded the minivan that took him and the rest of the expedition's biology team to the starship waiting out on the baking desert.
The dwindling dot of the starship finally became too small for the naked eye to see. The launch director's amplified voice boomed across the launch complex.
"The launch of Star Mission 1 is complete. All aspects of the launch are well within design parameters. Godspeed, Prometheus."
The huge crowd below them started to slowly, almost grudgingly, disperse to the parking lots neatly spread across the desert floor. The notables on the observation deck began to head indoors to the air-conditioned visitor's center and to the cocktail reception that awaited them. Thornberry heaved a melancholic sigh.
"Ah, well, the news conference will be starting soon. I suppose we should go in and let ourselves be admired."
Hamilton Cree was surprised to see such a crowd at the Rio Grande Gorge. Cars were parked along the shoulders of the road on both sides of the bridge as far as the eye could see. Vendors had set up tables beneath the bright morning sunlight, offering all sorts of handmade jewelry and trinkets, including replicas of the starship carved from local New Mexico stones.
"It's like a holiday," said his wife. "A regular festival."
Cree nodded, impressed.
"They've come to see the launch."
And he clutched his 5-year-old son's hand a little tighter.
"Do you think we'll see much from here?" his wife asked. "White Sands is a couple hundred miles from here, isn't it?"
Cree nodded at her. His superiors at the agency had given him his choice of unicorn offices with his latest promotion. To his own surprise, he had picked Albuquerque. And even stranger, he had driven his tiny family to this spot where he'd first seen Jordan Kell 6 years ago.
"We ought to get a good look at it."
And he led his wife and child up past the picnic tables and the makeshift lot jammed with cars, parked haphazardly every which way.
"Where's the starship?"
Hamilton Jr. asked, squinting into the bright morning sky. Cree glanced at his wristwatch.
"Ought to be coming up over the horizon, right about... Look!"
A streak of silver climbed above the horizon, carving an arch against the cloudless sky, that quickly morphed into a thin line that shifted to red, yellow, and finally deepest blue,
A rainbow!
Cree's wife shouted. Cree dropped one knee beside his son.
Look at it, Junior. That's the starship. It's going to another star.
His eyes fixed on the man-made rainbow as it sped across the sky, Junior nodded solemnly.
I want to go to the stars, too.
Cree smiled and told his son, You will, Junior. Someday you will. Dee Dee tousled her boy's hair.
When you grow up, honey, she said. When you grow up.
Jordan felt tired and somehow disappointed. The day had been long and emotionally draining, with a crowded news conference following the starship's launch, then speeches by the assembled politicians, including Jordan as the representative of the World Council, and finally a long liquor-soaked luncheon hosted by the governor of New Mexico, during which the politicians congratulated themselves on opening a new era of starflight for the human race. And finally, a one-on-one interview with the Otero Network's Nick Motrenko. He was close to exhaustion by the time he and Aditi reached their hotel suite. But as he sat on the bed and bent down to take off his shoes, Aditi touched his shoulder and said,
Audrey is calling.
The leader of the New Earth people appeared in solid three dimensions in the viewer on the opposite bedroom wall.
Friend Jordan, the old man said, and Aditi, my dear one, I call to offer you my congratulations on your success.
Audrey was standing, wearing a long robe of royal blue, filigreed with silver threads. His bald, wrinkled face was beaming at them contentedly. Without waiting for their response, Audrey went on.
Perhaps you don't fully appreciate the high accomplishment that you have achieved. The first rescue mission is a significant step in itself, but it is symbolic of something far greater.
Greater? Jordan blurted, knowing his word would take an hour to reach New Earth. With an almost guilty expression clouding his aged face, Audrey explained,
You see, this crisis of the death wave has actually been a test of your people's vision and resolve.
Jordan felt his brows narrow and saw that Aditi looked equally puzzled.
The death wave is a very real and very dangerous problem. Its threat to the less advanced civilizations is acute, gravely serious. Entire species of intelligent creatures are under a sentence of death unless you people of Earth help them.
We know that, Jordan said to himself. Audrey continued.
But there is something else involved as well. Something of even greater significance for the human race.
Greater significance, Jordan echoed.
You have led your people to starflight. You have succeeded in one of the most significant steps that any intelligent species can take.
Aditi moved to the bed and sat beside Jordan. The two of them watched Audrey's ancient-seamed face like a pair of schoolchildren listening to their tutor.
A species that achieves spaceflight, Audrey went on, has separated its fate from the fate of the planet that gave them birth. Once a species has spaceflight, it can survive a catastrophe that destroys the world of its birth. No natural disaster on its home planet, no global war or environmental devastation, can drive that species into extinction, for it has created new homes for itself elsewhere in its solar system. But in the long term, the very long term, the species' eventual fate is tied to the fate of its birth star. If Earth's sun explodes, or merely throws off a supermassive coronal flare, life on Earth, life throughout the solar system, could be wiped out. Starflight gives your species a way to separate its fate from the fate of its home star. With starflight, the human race can live for untold eons, spreading through the galaxy and giving rise to new intelligences, both biological and electronic. That is why starflight is so important. It guarantees the immortality of your species and its descendants.
Audrey fell silent. Jordan started to reply, found his throat was dry. Aditi said,
And the rescue missions we are undertaking are merely the first steps toward creating a true interstellar civilization.
Jordan found his voice. We won't get his answer for another hour, at least. She nodded. He grasped her wrist and led her to the glass sliders of their balcony. As they stepped into the dark, cloudless desert night, Jordan murmured, "Astronomy began in the desert." Gazing up at the thousands of bright pinpoints sparkling across the dark sky, Aditi said,
"Yes, I'm sure that's right."
For long moments they stared upward. Jordan pointed out the dippers, the fainter dragon twining between them, the lopsided W of Cassiopeia, and in the opposite direction, Orion climbing above the distant horizon. "There's a story from the Old Testament," Jordan told her, his voice oddly low, "about God taking Abraham out into the desert night and telling him, 'I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky.'"
"That must have pleased Abraham."
"I'm sure it did. But I've always interpreted those words in a slightly different way. I think what they mean is that we will populate the stars in the sky. We will become a true interstellar civilization." Aditi leaned her head on his shoulder.
"And we're taking the first step now."
"Yes, now," Jordan replied. "But it's only the first step." Above them, the stars beckoned. This concludes the reading of Death Wave by Ben Bova. Copyright 2015 by Ben Bova. This book was read by Stefan Rudnicki and directed by Cassandra DeCure. Edited, mixed, and mastered by Ken Barton. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with the Barbara Bova Literary Agency and was produced in 2015 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.